Welcome to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, our monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallblom. For August, we'll catch up on the season of the century for the Waterloo Community Playhouse. We'll congratulate Hancher as they put the finishing touches on their new architectural gym and prepare to roll out the red carpet. We'll learn about the Des Moines Symphony's upcoming 2016-17 season. We'll follow the yellow brick road inside the Figge Art Museum. And we'll commend the Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Festival as they celebrate 45 years of honoring Iowa's jazz legend Bix Beiderbecke. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Thanks for joining us.
It all started in 1971 when a group came from New Jersey to pay tribute to Bix Beiderbecke, called the Bix Memorial Jazz Band, led by Bill Barnes and Bill Donahoe, and a trumpet player as well as a washboard player. And they came from New Jersey and played at Bix's grave and were greeted by the musicians in the local community. We also had the Davenport Jazz Band, which was led by Don Odette, who is a great cornet player here in the Quad Cities. And they had a battle of the band, or like a whole night of jamming at what was then the Holiday Inn on Brady Street. And it went until the wee hours of the morning, I heard, like till 5 or 6 in the morning. And that was the start of what we have now. And in 1972, that was the official, let's say, first festival. But 1971 is when the actual kickoff, let's say, happened. Even though it was just a jam session and the guys were coming, that's when we feel it officially started. And Don Odette really was the person who spearheaded the Bix Society and kept everything going. And we have our Bix Beiderbecke Memorial that's down by the LeClaire Park Bandshell in downtown Davenport. And on the side of it, you will see a plaque there dedicated to Don Odette. And without him, the Bix Society wouldn't be going like it is today. He's the one that spearheaded that in 1971 and really got things off the ground, thinking, hey, we could have a big jazz festival here, bringing bands in from all over the country that play this music and want to pay tribute to Bix Beiderbecke. So he's, I think, the big reason why we are where we are today.
Josh Duffy, president and music director of the Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Society Board of Directors. The 45th annual Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Festival continues now through tomorrow in the Quad Cities. The family entertainment event is one of the most unique and longest-running jazz festivals in the country. It's noted for its hospitality and not only includes live bands and jamming, but also dancing. Josh Duffy was one of the charter members of the Bix Youth Band, which started in 1998, and whose original members and their families still return every year to attend the Bix Festival. Josh is now considered one of the world's finest 1920s style percussionists and an expert jazz historian. Josh gives us some background on Bix's life and career.
He was born here in Davenport, Iowa on March 10th of 1903. Times back in Davenport are a lot different than what they are today. People have to imagine that the main source of entertainment was dancing and going to ballrooms and hearing these great dance bands of the early 20s. And when Bix was in his teens, there in the 1910s, he was going down to the riverfront. And it was just like a big sandy beach, and the big riverboats were coming up from New Orleans and going up to the Minnesota area and coming back down. And he was listening to a great band on there, the King Oliver Band, which had a young Louis Armstrong playing with them, and Fate Marabelle's band. A bunch of these great musicians from New Orleans were coming up, and so he was hearing this great style of music that wasn't hitting this area too much, and so that was really exciting for him to be running down to the river and hearing that when they'd hear the whistle for the boat or the calliope being played. And he got a lot of his influence around 1917 when the original Dixieland Jazz Band released their first records for the Victor Company. And he heard Nick LaRocca playing cornet. and was just blown away by that. He had been trained classically with the piano, but had an ear for music and could, if somebody played a melody or anything on the piano, he could play it back right away. And the story goes, Bix's mother, Agatha, played organ at the First Presbyterian Church on Iowa Avenue here in Davenport, and she would bring the children to the church when she'd be playing on Sundays and put them up in the balcony, and she would angle her mirror on the organ to make sure that she had her eyes on all the children that were sitting up in the balcony while she was still playing. And Vix's father was really into the Butterbeck Lumber Company that was in downtown Davenport, and so I'm sure with it being a strong German family, they wanted Bix to carry on in the family tradition and carry the family business going. But Bix's mind was in other places. It was with the performing arts, with that music that just touched his heart and soul, and he just couldn't get it out. And so Bix then ventured into the jazz era of music in the early 1920s and was playing with the Wolverine Orchestra, and they recorded their first sides for the Jeanette Recording Company in Richmond, Indiana. And that studio was also next to the Star Piano Company, who supplied the piano for the studio. And Bix's first sides with the Wolverines are some of the most iconic sides, because musicians were hearing this guy from Davenport, who they're like, who's this Bix by from Davenport, and they were hearing what he was doing, and it was so ahead of the time for music that musicians were drawn to his playing, what he was doing with his solos and his creativeness, and they were trying to be like Bix, and Bix wasn't trying to be like anybody but himself, and that's what really made him stand out amongst other musicians of the time. And so his life, in a nutshell, in the 1920s was with a few bands, with the Wolverine Orchestra, and then moving on to the Gene Goldkett Orchestra for a short amount of time, and then he did some work with Frank Trumbauer's orchestra, and then came back with the Goldkett band, and then they went with Adrian Rollini's New Yorkers, because Adrian played bass sax on his recordings in 1927. Great, great musicians. That group was a very short-lived band, so as soon as that band folded, he did go with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, and then that's where he finished out his career until he passed away in 1931 on August 6th.
And he was basically a self-taught trumpeter, too.
Yeah, and it was listening to those original Dixieland Jazz Band records that he received a cornet from his friend here in Davenport and would sit next to the Victrola and would play along and would just figure out the notes. He didn't know what pushing the valves down meant. He was just pushing them down when he heard the pitch that matched what was on the record, then he would remember that. Okay, these two make that sound. And so he could read music as time went on. And that was a big thing when he had his audition for the Musicians Union here in Davenport. They put a hard piece in front of him, and he couldn't play it. And so he couldn't get a job with some of the bands here. And so then he went and re-auditioned again, but after doing some reading and learning how to get through the music, then he just passed the union audition where he was able to go play with the dance bands in Davenport.
Looking over his life, what do you think his impact has had on music in America?
I think it's been huge, and even not so much America, but even worldwide, is that one thing is when I travel abroad and I'm in either England or Australia or somewhere where we're playing Bix's music, and they mention from the stage that I'm from Davenport, Iowa, people come up to me afterwards and like, you're from Bix's hometown. And so that's really exciting to be like, wow, people know about Bix around the world, because he was so superior what he was doing with his sound and style that people would flock to see him all the time. But I think with Bix, it was just that creativeness that was drawing musicians in from all over the world. But the impact that he has on the music today is he's still influencing young musicians. As soon as they hear a record by him, they're drawn to it. And that's what happened to me when I first heard it back in the late 90s when I was in high school. I heard a Bix record, and I believe it was at the Jazz Band Ball. And then I also heard him playing with the Gene Goldkett Band. And as soon as I heard that, I was hooked for life. And when you listen through and hear that music on those original 78s from the 1920s, that music and the quality of the musicianship is so high, it just draws you in.
Josh outlines today's impressive Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Festival lineup.
We have a lot of great bands coming in from around the country. One that we'll highlight is a neat duo, which is made up of Randy Sankey from the New York area, as well as Dick Hyman on piano. And Dick Hyman, I believe, is turning 90, like 89 or 90, and still playing fantastic. And this is a guy who has really contributed to Bix's style of music for many years and is known worldwide. And so they're doing just a duo of cornet and piano, which those were Bix's two instruments that he played as he was growing growing up. And hearing these guys play, I mean, you're really close to Bix, because, like, wow, this is like hearing two people that idolize Bix, and it's like hearing Bix at both instruments, which is really neat. We have a group called the Lakeshore Syncopators, which are coming in from Chicago, Illinois, so they bring in that Chicago-style sound, and it's led by the drummer Steve Tirico, and they bring in a cornet player named Mike Davis from New York who loves Bix, and he's another young musician in his 20s that's doing this music all over the New York City area. And what makes it neat as well is that we have Andy Shum on bass saxophone, and Andy plays cornet with a great group in Chicago called the Fat Babies, and Andy's a multi-instrumentalist who is one of the best in the style today anywhere in the world, and so he'll be playing bass sax with this band, kind of emulating that Adrian Rollini sound. And the group is made up of just all-star musicians who capture that style of Bix in the Chicago days, as well as like the California Ramblers and Red Nichols and those other musicians that Bix liked as well. We have Dave Bennett coming in from Michigan, and Dave Bennett is known for his Benny Goodman sound on the clarinet, and so he's coming in with his quartet to emulate all those great Benny Goodman songs from 30s and 40s when Benny was really popular, but he does jump back into the 1920s for some tunes and play some of those that Benny was playing with the Ben Pollock band at the time and just having a good time with the Chicago guys. We have Miss Jubilee and her Humdingers coming in from St. Louis, and if you kind of like that St. Louis early blues style music, she belts it out vocally like that, and they have been here, I think, last couple of years, and the people at the festival here love that band, and so people can hear them and come out and dance. They play dances all around the country, and it's neat that they're another young group of musicians from St. Louis that are really making a big draw down there, so it's nice to have them here. And we have my 10-piece band, the Greystone Monarchs, doing music in a 10-piece style, so you hear three saxophones, two trumpets, trombones, so again, different instrumentation from what the other bands are that I've already mentioned. Another one that people may get a little bit confused about is the Rock Island Roustabouts. They're not from Rock Island, Illinois, but it's the Rock Island Line, which was the train. And this is made up of musicians from all over the country that play this style of music. They're coming to Davenport to play. And it's a great group of musicians, and it's also co-led by Jeff Barnhart, who is a great ragtime piano player, and co-leads the band with Hal Smith, the drummer. And they're in for a treat because Jeff really can play the piano amazingly. And that's what makes it neat, is that we tried to really pick some great bands and make it a little bit different for our 45th this year. And I think with the entertainment that people are going to hear on the Saturday night, they're going to be walking out just like, wow, that was amazing, and it's right here in the Quad City area, which is exciting because it's Bix's area and we're paying tribute to him.
Josh Duffy, President and Music Director of the Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Society Board of Directors. The Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Festival, featuring the best of professional and traditional jazz performances, continues today at noon in Bettendorf and tonight at 6 in Davenport. Tomorrow, festival performances include liturgical services in Davenport and a massive jam session in Milan, Illinois. For exact details on the Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Festival, please see their website at bixsociety.org. Also showing at Davenport's Putnam Museum through Labor Day is the Discovery of King Tut exhibit. Continuing through September 11th, the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art is showing Rodin, Portraits of a Lifetime. CR's National Czech and Slovak Museum is hosting a Warhol birthday celebration today, an Amadeus costume exhibit opening on August 12th, and throwing a Mozart and pop art party on August 24th. Just ahead, you'll see how Hanger is making ready for their opening night. You'll catch the inside scoop on the Des Moines Symphony's 2016-17 concert lineup. You'll marvel at the magnitude of Willard Carroll and Tom Wilhite's Oz collection. And you'll learn about the Waterloo Community Playhouse as they turn 100. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
We're not just entertainment. We hope to be a center for the community to come together and exchange ideas and to examine their values and to come together. Yeah, there's an aspect of fellowship that occurs in live performance that you don't have in a movie. In a movie theater, you're all strangers. But in our theater, you're all friends and neighbors.
Norman Ussery, the executive director of the Waterloo Community Playhouse. Norman shares a bit of history as the Waterloo Community Playhouse this season celebrates 100 years of theater in the Cedar Valley.
We were created in 1916. A woman by the name of Miriam Marsh Clark had gone to Vassar, and when she graduated, she came home to Waterloo and decided we need to have theater. And so she started the Waterloo Drama League, which has become the Waterloo Community Playhouse and Black Hawk Children's Theater. And from that very beginning, the theater continued, and we're among the five oldest in the nation, and we were the first theater of any kind established in the state of Iowa.
Which is amazing. And I think what's even more amazing is that you started this during World War I.
Yes, and actually for our theater, during World War I, they slowed to a crawl, almost no programming, because there were so many people involved in the war effort from this area. And the same thing happened during World War II.
Now, you started out in a church. Tell us about after you moved out of the church, you were in a furnace room for a while before you got your own home.
We were, and it was actually a time called Theater in Your Lap, which actually persisted into the late 50s and early 60s. And the theater seated 60 people, and it was an effort to keep the art form going and to keep live entertainment.
So I think the really big climb came when they not only moved into the Hope Martin Theater, but also when they hired their first full-time director.
Well, actually, their first full-time director was in 1916. A man by the name of Charles Glick was our first paid full-time director. And we've had a paid staff of some sort off and on throughout the entire history. But the big move was into the Hope Martin Theater. Dorothy Fay made a large contribution in support of the city refurbishing what was then the Rec Center and adding a 360-seat theater, which was named for her father, Hope Martin. So we have the Hope Martin Theater now as part of the Waterloo Center for the Arts. And the Waterloo Community Playhouse and Black Hawk Children's Theater have been resident there now for over 50 years. The Arts Center is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year as we celebrate our 100th. And it's really kind of interesting the commitment the community has made to the arts.
Norman fills us in on the exciting season of the century, celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Waterloo Community Playhouse.
The season, actually, it was a great idea from one of our committee members. Since we're celebrating 100 years of history and we're doing 10 shows, we tried to choose one show to represent each decade of our history. So the opening show of our season was Singin' in the Rain, which celebrates the end of the silent film era of the teens and 20s. Then coming up next in September, we're going to be doing To Kill a Mockingbird, which is very topical right now because of the new novel, Go Set a Watchman. But also, To Kill a Mockingbird is a part of our history and culture that takes place in the 30s. And also, we're going to be doing two outreach events, one at Jubilee United Methodist Church in Waterloo and one at the Waterloo Public Library, where we're going to have some of our actors on hand to read some bits from the book and then to perform a couple of short scenes from the play and then discuss some of the issues that are raised by it. We're also, during the week in between weekend performances, going to do a panel discussion, which will be led by Reverend Abraham Funches, who is the head here of the Human Rights Commission, to talk about the social and racial justice issues that are raised by the play and that are raised in our community, to sort of take a look at To Kill a Mockingbird, set in a small Alabama town in 1935, and see what parallels and differences we have to Waterloo in 2016. Then we're coming along to the 40s when Pippi Longstocking was written. Then we move into the 50s, and this is going over to the Children's Theater, with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis. And then we come back to the 60s. We're doing the musical version of A Christmas Story. That's a familiar title from the movie about little Ralphie who wants a gun for Christmas And they keep telling him, oh, no, you can't have that. You'll shoot your eye out. Then next, we're on to the 70s. And in 1975, a play debuted in London called The Rocky Horror Show. It later became a movie and is now sort of a cult classic. We're going to be doing that live on stage, and that represents the 70s. Then come into the 80s, there was a very important book called The Bridge to Terabithia, which is a touching tale of two young people who form an incredible creative bond and then have to deal with loss. Then we come also into the 80s with Neil Simon's comedy Rumours. We felt we couldn't do a retrospective without including Neil Simon somewhere. And then a newer book for young people called Amazing Grace, about a little girl who wants to be Peter Pan in the school play. And nobody wants to let her. Well, Grace is stronger than they are. And then we're going to conclude the season in June with the newest show of the bunch, which actually takes us back to medieval times with Monty Python's Spamalot. And with Spamalot, we are going to do the first and possibly first annual Spam Jam, a spam cook-off. We're going to have a team of celebrity chefs and also an amateur division doing their best to create interesting creations with spam. And oddly enough, you know, the Spam Museum is just up the road in Minnesota, and they're going to come and participate with us, with the folks from Hormel. And there are a couple of varieties of spam, flavors that are not available in the continental U.S., that they're going to be debuting here.
So how can folks get more tickets and more info?
You can find the Playhouse. We are very present on social media. Look us up on Facebook, WLU Playhouse. You can also find us online at WLUPlayhouse.org. We're not hard to find. Just Google us.
The executive director of the Waterloo Community Playhouse, Norman Usserly. Just ahead, you'll get the inside scoop on the Des Moines Symphony's 2016-17 Pops concert lineup. You'll hear what cool over-the-rainbow artifacts are currently on display at the Figge. And we'll give Hancher a standing ovation for their soon-to-be unveiling and opening night. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
Cesar Pelli really designed a building that is full of adventure even before you get in and you see what's on stage. The building itself creates a feeling of adventure, I think is the best way to put it. Like from the very beginning, everybody understood how special Hancher was, and they all really knew that this was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Very complicated, but yet they knew that they were designing and building something that would be transforming lives for years and years to come.
Chuck Swanson, executive director of Hancher Auditorium. Hancher got the keys to their new front door on June 1st. Since then, the auditorium has been a beehive of activity, including the installation of two amazing artworks.
The first piece, as you walk in the doors, it's just right there, right above the grand staircase. It's a piece of art that is by a West African artist. His name is Elu Natsui. And 2 years ago, he got the Golden Lion Award in Venice, which is the artist of the world. And this piece of art is thousands of pieces of recycled material that he put together through copper wire. The Des Moines Art Center, several years ago, had an exhibit of his, and people came from all over the country to see his pieces of art. He's got them in major museums across the country. And Cesar Pelli, the design architect for Hancher, he said, get it. He didn't even want to see it because he knew that he wanted a piece of El's work in his building. And he's a West African professor. He's a professor who's actually hires students to help him put this piece of art together, and then he pays them in scholarship money. And what I have found is Elu Natsui's niece and nephew actually work here at the University of Iowa. So there's connections all over the place here. And then we have another piece of art that was installed, and this piece of art reflects the work that Hancher has done for years and years and years across the state, and also work that we have done with young people, K through 12th graders, So Hancher commissioned Anita Jung. She's a professor here at the School of Art and Art History. She's a printmaker. And 2 years ago this fall, Anita and I went to 7 schools across the state. The communities are Council Bluffs, Storm Lake, Spencer, Algona, Muscatine, Maquoketa, and Iowa City. And we connected with the 7th grade art teachers. And then Anita had these students from the art classes in those schools. She had them take selfies. And then she had them trace their selfies. We had each one of these students write about what performance means to them. And it didn't have to be performing arts. You know, some of them wrote about soccer. And then they took their words of performance and they wrote them around the trace selfie. And this is a 21-foot piece of art. And the teachers selected certain selfies, and then there's 7 panels, and each panel represents a community. So she put these selfies together with a blueprint of Hancher and then maps of each one of the communities. And then she also, in order to get all of the students involved in this, she took the measurement of every one of the students that were a part of this project, and then she wrote their name. So those two pieces of art mean a lot. And the piece that Anita did, the title of it is We All Perform. And I'm just there again excited to share both of these pieces of art with everybody.
So tell us about these opening things that you have going on and a freebie that's going to be happening.
Well, this is probably the most exciting time, I think, ever in the 44 years of Hancher's history. And on August 26th, we're going to be done with everything and ready to go. And we're going to have a hard hat performance. We're bringing a band in from Chicago called Mukapatsa. And we want all these construction workers, these workers who have worked so hard, we want them to sit in those seats and we want them to enjoy the fruits of their labor. So we're going to have a big celebration that night. And then September 9th, and 11th, we're going to have open houses. We're really looking at this from the standpoint of Hancher is for everybody. So on the 9th at 3 o'clock, we're going to have a ribbon cutting. And this ribbon cutting will take place from the stage. And then at 4 o'clock, we're going to turn it around where we're going to have the doors totally open. We're going to have self-guided tours. And we want everybody to just squeeze everything they can out of the building. Everybody's waited so long, and the building is so beautiful. I want people to be able to get up on that stage, and I want them to be able to look out at the auditorium. I always say that's the best seat in the house. I'm really excited for people from all corners of the state to be able to come and to be able to see Hancher. So on Friday, the 9th, 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock, is the open house. And then on Sunday from 2 to 5, the open house will continue. And on September 16th, we're going to have a free outdoor concert. And this will start at 7:30. This will be Trombone Shorty and Preservation Hall Jazz Band. They'll each do their separate sets. Trombone Shorty is from New Orleans, and he plays more than the trombone. And he and his band will lead off, and then Preservation Hall Jazz Band that opened Hancher back in 1972, they too know the story, and they are ready for this. So we're going to have an outdoor stage set up on the new drive that is to the east of the building, and then the grassy area to the south where the old original Hancher used to be. People will bring their chairs, their blankets, and we're going to have actually a parking lot that is going to be reserved for tailgating. And that's going to be a busy, busy day, but yet what an exciting day for all of us. And then we get to where we do have our first ticketed Hancher event, and that's on September 24th. And believe it or not, Steve Martin and Martin Short are sold out. And really the only thing sold out at this point is the Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Yo-Yo Ma. Otherwise, tickets are available. And we have, I think, a great offering of events. I think there's something in there for everybody. I think everybody can find something in that season that would be of interest to them.
Andrew's Executive Director, Chuck Swanson. For more details about concerts and other events, go to hancher.uiowa.edu. Don't go away. You'll discover how the Wonderful World of Oz exhibit found its way to the Quad Cities. And you'll hear the amazing guest artist roster showcasing the Des Moines Symphony's 2016-17 season. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
You know, hearing a live symphony orchestra is unlike any experience that people will ever have, regardless of the technology now. When you come into a concert hall and you hear a live symphony orchestra, it's a magnificent experience, and it's a far different and, in my opinion, better experience than any recording that you'll ever have.
Maestro Joseph Junta, the Des Moines Symphony's artistic director and conductor. The Des Moines Symphony's Ode to Joy 2016-17 season opens with that Beethoven monumental masterpiece.
79 years, you know, just stop and think about that. 79 consecutive years, even through World War II and economic distress and the economy going up and down. I mean, it's pretty amazing that Central Iowa has supported an orchestra for all those years, and we're very proud of it. It's one of the oldest orchestras in our country. But we begin this wonderful masterwork series with our season, which is called the Ode to Joy season, and of course, we're starting with Beethoven's wonderful Ode to Joy, the Ninth Symphony. That's the Choral Symphony. It's going to be including the Drake Choir and Simpson College Chamber Singers and Des Moines Vocal Arts Ensemble. Whenever you start a season with the Beethoven Ninth, it raises the bar pretty high for the rest of the season. And that program also includes the Rossini William Tell Overture and J.S. Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 5. So there's a lot of variety and certainly a lot of appeal to that program. Our next concert, we're titling A German Rhapsody. This includes music by Wagner and Mozart and Richard Strauss's Till Eulenspiegel, also with the Brahms Violin Concerto being played by Vadim Gluzman, who was here in Des Moines in 1999 and has gone on to an illustrious career playing with the Berlin Philharmonic and the London Philharmonic and the Vienna Philharmonic, and now is coming to Des Moines to play this wonderful violin concerto. Our third program is called Romeo and Rock 2, and this includes Lise de La Salle, who's a young pianist that I heard in Aspen last summer. She is a brilliant artist. I heard her recital in Aspen and went up to her right afterwards and hired her on the spot. She's going to be playing the beautiful Rachmaninoff Second Piano Concerto. And we're surrounding it with all Russian music. We're beginning the program with a Tchaikovsky Romeo and Juliet Overture Fantasy, playing some excerpts from also Romeo and Juliet by Prokofiev, and then ending with a piece that has never been done with the Des Moines Symphony, the Bored and Polovetsian Dances from Prince Igor, which is a real showcase for the orchestra. After the first of the year, our masterwork season will continue with a program called Cathedrals of Sound, conducted by the wonderful female conductor Joanne Folletta. Joanne's been a friend for a very long time, and she's a terrific conductor that conducts both music director in Buffalo and also in Virginia. Joanne will be conducting the Brahms Academic Festival Overture and the Bruckner Symphony No. 4, the Romantic Symphony of Bruckner. And her guest artist will be the Oasis Saxophone Quartet, and they will be playing Bill Bolcom's Concerto Grosso for Saxophone Quartet, which is a wonderful, brilliant piece of music. Our fifth masterwork series in March will include the Mendelssohn music from A Midsummer Night's Dream, and Ravel's wonderful orchestration of Mussorgsky's pictures at an exhibition. And our visiting artist will be Robert Edward Tees, who was here with George Mester several years ago. He's a pianist, and he's going to play the wonderful Brahms Piano Concerto No. 2, which, as you know, is a tour de force for orchestra and piano. Our programs will continue in April. Our sixth masterwork of the season is another Beyond the Score, a partnership with the great Chicago Symphony Orchestra. This time we're doing the Berlioz Symphony Fantastique, and it will include an actor that I think our audience is really going to like. His name is Matthew Krauss, and I heard him portray Berlioz, and he looks like him, and he sounds like him, and this is really a great Beyond the Score. and I know people will enjoy learning more about how Berlioz composed this wonderful Symphonie Fantastique. And finally, our masterwork season ends with what we're calling American Gothic and Bolero. This is a program that basically was programmed around Michael Dougherty's American Gothic piece, which Orchestra Iowa did the debut and recorded several years ago. I happened to be at that concert, and at that time I saw Michael Dougherty, who's a Cedar Rapids native, currently teaching at the University of Michigan, composition teacher there. And I asked Michael, I said, the piece is so good. I said, I think it's even going to be better with film. And his eyes got as big as a kid in a candy store and said, boy, wouldn't that be great? So we have now hired Bocce Ball Film Crew. This is an Iowa City film crew, and they're going to be putting some great cinematography to Michael's American Gothic based on, of course, the Grant Wood work. And that program also has the Hindemith Symphonic Metamorphosis. Matt Heimovitz, the wonderful cellist, will be here playing the Sansol First Cello Concerto, and we're going to end the season with a magnificent Bolero by Maurice Ravel. So it's a season that has a lot of appeal, a lot of wonderful music, and I know that people will want to attend and get their tickets as soon as possible.
So how can folks get tickets?
Ticketmaster is always a good way, or by getting on our website. That website is dmsymphony.org. And I also would be remiss if I didn't mention the second year of our POPs concerts that we're doing. And I think we've put together three really wonderful POPs programs for people who POPs music appeals to. The first one being in November. This is going to be conducted by George Dougherty. We're calling it Warner Brothers Presents Bugs Bunny at the Symphony 2. We played a program like this about 5 or 6 years ago. It continues to be one of the most requested programs we have ever done. So we're bringing you back. And a screen hangs above the orchestra and these wonderful Bugs Bunny cartoons that many of us remember from Saturday mornings are going to be played while the orchestra does this great music. Music by Wagner and Lehar and Brahms and Mozart and von Suppe. All this great music that is the background for those programs will be played by the live Des Moines Symphony. On New Year's Eve, of course, which has sold out the last 7 consecutive years, we've put together a program called Sinatra at 100 and Beyond. And we've invited Steve Lippia back, a wonderful artist who's living in Las Vegas. He's put together a terrific salute to Frank Sinatra. He actually sounds like Frank Sinatra. And there's going to be some video montage that goes along with this. And then in conjunction with the Civic Center in February 25th of 2017, is the beautiful and funny and exciting, vibrant actress and singer, Kristen Chenoweth. She'll be performing with the Des Moines Symphony in partnership with the Civic Center of Greater Des Moines. So it's a great, great pop series for our audiences, I think.
And those tickets also available through Ticketmaster?
They are, through Ticketmaster or through our website, dmsymphony.org.
The Des Moines Symphony's artistic director and conductor, Maestro Junta. On August 11th, the Des Moines Symphony brings Broadway star Hugh Panero back to Iowa, along with the Vintage Sound Barbershop Quartet, to present a patriotic opening night concert at the Iowa State Fair. Their 6:30 p.m. performance at the fair's free Mid-American Energy Stage will showcase Peter Hamlin's Symphony on a Stick, plus feature special film scenes that reflect Peter's original State Fair inspirations. Just ahead, we'll take a trip to Davenport to investigate the Figge Art Museum's Willard Carroll and Tom Wilhite collection and hear from a Judy Garland and Wizard of Oz expert about the exhibit. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
Ray Bolger, who played the Scarecrow in the movie, said it best on an episode of the Judy Garland Show. He said, God gives everybody those gifts, but you have to use them. And if you use them properly, they lead you home to the people you love and the people who love you. That's a home, not a house. It's people. And I think all of that resonates. Kids fall in love with the story because it's the story of a child. And Judy's power as a communicator sweeps them in instantly to that story. They go along on the journey. And as a teenager, we all go through that period of, oh gosh, am I brave? Am I smart? Am I loving? Is anybody going to ever love me? And as an adult, hopefully, you come to realize that just take what you've got and implement it and make it work for you. And be yourself, most of all. It is a rare film that can embody all of that, plus hit songs, plus Technicolor, plus 124 Munchkins. I mean, the movie has everything. What can I tell you?
Tom and Willard, they love sharing Oz. You know, Willard goes, you know, when you look in the gallery, people are smiling. And it's just a great thing. And so I think that's why part of the reason that Oz has so many fans is, like Willard said, it's the ultimate buddy movie, this complete band of misfits, you know. And he said, and they're all looking for something that they already have. That's part of its appeal, is that it's such a classic story and it's so much about friendship and support and all that stuff.
Judy Garland and Wizard of Oz guest historian John Fricke, along with Tim Schiffer, Figge Art Museum's executive director. The Willard Carroll and Tom Wilhite Wonderful World of Oz exhibit has a connection to the Quad Cities. Tom Wilhite's great uncle worked at the Davenport Paper, which was owned by the Adler family. The Bank and Trust was also owned by the Adler and Figge families, and the Figges gave the gift that named the museum. Tom and Willard were willing to trust treasures from their Oz collection with the Figge Art Museum.
They offered the collection to us a couple years ago, and it's not a traditional art exhibition, but we just felt it was an opportunity to bring this really unique collection to town. And in the larger cultural sense, it's like an icon of American culture. And as it turns out, they've decided that they're not going to travel it again. They're planning to make their own museum in Maine. This is probably the last time it's going to go on the road, so we're really lucky. The visuals are great. The original book came out in 1900, and it was illustrated by W.W. Denslow. And the characters have gone through all these different depictions over the years through the books, and then the publicity for the musical that was based on the books. And then, of course, the movie kind of solidified all the characters into the iconic Dorothy and, you know, the Lion and the Scarecrow and the Tin Man. And that's really kind of what we know. But then it has a life after that with The Wiz and Wicked, and there's all kinds of books that are still coming out. So it's this story that has a life of its own, and it also has kind of an iconography to it that changes over the years. And it's kind of interesting, you know, now with Wicked, maybe our culture, we go back to stories and look at the backstory of what happened before something happened. And so it's a reflection of our culture and how it changes over time. And Willard spoke here when we opened the show, and he said, you know, that the thing that makes the movie really amazing is that Judy Garland totally plays it straight, even though it's a completely surreal picture and really radical for the 30s to do that kind of a fairy tale surreal thing with the poppies and the Emerald City and very far out there. He really thinks that's what really clinches the story, is that Judy Garland is just so sincere and so believable. And if you read the book, the ruby slippers aren't in the book, but they're like one of the features of Technicolor that came with the movie. And he pointed out the movie went through, I think, four different directors. And, you know, directors were journeymen. They weren't artistes like they are now. And they would just, if one didn't work out, they'd can him and bring in another. But somehow all the elements of the movie came together to make just this kind of masterpiece of American movie making of the period. And then, you know, of course, the individual characters, the Scarecrow and Burt Lahr as the Lion and Margaret Hamilton as the Wicked Witch of the West, you know, they're just unforgettable.
Well, tell us about these two gentlemen that have become obsessed with the Wizard of Oz.
You know, Willard started collecting when he was a kid, and he remembers watching the movie, and he would be on his little spring-loaded rocking horse in front of the TV set watching it, and whenever the Wicked Witch came on, he'd like run out of the room until she was gone. And he started really early on collecting, and like many collectors, he is a little bit obsessed in a good way with it. You know, he's got tens of thousands of items, and we have a little over 100 here that are kind of the cream of the crop, the hourglass from the movie, the screen test dress, and the Munchkin costume, which is the best preserved costume from the movie, because a lot of the costumes got recycled in Hollywood, because there again, it was before they thought of these things as icons or as collectibles, you know, so they're really rare. And then mostly the show is the visuals, really the posters, the dolls and kind of commercial items that were produced. The little flying monkey figurine is pretty amazing. It's really kind of a look at just the tip of the iceberg of the collection.
So tell us about some of the activities you have coming up this month.
On the 13th of August, we're showing a 35mm print of the movie at the Adler Theater in Davenport. And it's a print that was made in 1998 using the same printing method that was used to make the original movie. And from what Tom and Willard say, it's like seeing it in a completely new way, to see it on the big screen in this print. And actually, to see it as an adult and you see the humor and all the kind of vaudeville aspects of it, because it's really kind of a stage show put in a movie, which is what they used to do. And the scenes with the Munchkins and the crowd scenes and the scenery, it's just so over the top. And some of the outfits, I mean, the Munchkins' hair, it's great. It's just wild. And it's funny. It's very, very funny. And actually, John Fricke, where there are two showings at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m., he's going to introduce each showing and talk a little bit about the movie. So it's a real opportunity to, you know, have the person who probably knows the most of anyone about that movie talk about it impromptu. And I'm sure he'll be very engaging.
Tim Schiffer. Historian John Fricke, who garnered two Emmys, one for his 10th anniversary A&E Judy Garland special, and one for his co-writing and producing the Judy Garland By Myself PBS American Masters special, shares how he got hooked on Oz.
I saw The Wizard of Oz the very first time 60 years ago, this coming November, because it's the 60th anniversary of its TV debut. I was 5 at the time in Wisconsin, and it just impacted on me. I loved music, and I loved that kind of entertainment, and I started to research Frank Baum, who wrote the Oz books, and Judy, and all of that kind of stuff on my own from the time I was 7 or 8 years old in the Milwaukee Public Library. And it just snowballed, joining fan clubs for Oz and Judy and writing for the fanzines and majoring in journalism at Northwestern, but performing very much on the side and moving to New York. I sang for many years, nightclubs, cruise ships. That's how I got to be the Miss Iowa pageant host for 8 consecutive years, 1979 to 1986. But along the way, I put the journalism degree into play and was the writer of the 50th anniversary coffee table book about the Wizard of Oz movie in 1989. And that really launched it all. There have been 7 books now, 4 on Oz and 3 on Judy, documentaries, CDs, DVDs. It was never supposed to become this. But about 15 years ago, I woke up one morning and I thought, well, this must be what I'm supposed to be doing with my life, because this is what I'm doing with my life. And it's lucky to have a passion for topics that have turned out to be as timeless as The Wizard of Oz and Judy Garland. There's a lot of other pop culture that was very big at the time or very big for a time, but very little that has endured the way those two entities have.
And you even had the marvelous opportunity to meet Judy Garland.
That's very true. There aren't a lot of reasons to be glad to be 65, but one of them is that I am old enough to have seen Judy in concert 3 times, and I met her when I was 16, after one of those concerts in the Pump Room Restaurant Supper Club of the Ambassador East Hotel in Chicago at 2 o'clock in the morning. And she was as warm and welcoming and wonderful as I always knew she'd be, and as I had no right to expect her to be, to a total stranger when she was not being Judy Garland. She was done being Judy Garland. She was just Frances Gum of Grand Rapids, Minnesota, having her dinner after work. But I am very grateful for many, many things, but that's one of the most extraordinary.
Now, you have had the opportunity to meet Willard Carroll and Tom Wilhite. Tell us just a little bit about these two guys and this marvelous collection.
Well, Willard and I are both lifelong Oz fans. He met me after that first book came out, and eventually hired me to write the text of two books built around his collection and the whole arc of history of Oz. The first book was 100 Years of Oz, and then we expanded it 3 years ago, new book called The Wonderful World of Oz. And so we started out as friends and fellow fans, but became very, very much professional admirers of the work each other has done. And to be surrounded by that stuff, it's an American phenomenon, Oz, not because I say so, but because it's endured for well over 100 years and spawned so many joy-inducing properties. And Willard and Tom's collection embraces all of that. And now it's being shared, which doesn't always happen. You've got to have an establishment like the Figge that is totally trustworthy and first class to put this stuff out there for people to see.
I wasn't that familiar with her other work, and one of the free TV stations has been showing some of these old television shows of Judy Garland, and I was just amazed at her guests and performance.
Well, that's just it. Those shows have been rerun on Get TV. In fact, they're doing a full Monday night of Garland programming on Monday, August 8th, and then again early in September. Three different episodes each time from those TV shows. And people hear the legend of Judy Garland, and they have all kinds of preconceived notions, and then she comes out looking great and singing great and performing great and being funny and being real, and people fall down. Because it's like, how many other 4'11" women can stand there and sing Old Man River or the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which she does on one of the shows immediately after President Kennedy was assassinated? She doesn't mention Jack Kennedy. She doesn't mention the fact they were friends. She just comes out and sings the song. And it's live singing and no pre-recording and no lip-syncing and no flash powder or snakes or anything. It's just one woman singing the heck out of a song. And she did that week after week, concert after concert.
She was incredibly amazing. Well, how did she get cast for this Wizard of Oz, and outline how she became involved with this project?
Well, Judy had been at MGM for 2 years. In 1937, she had her first big breakthrough as a performer in the movie Broadway Melody, and she sang Dear Mr. Gable, You Made Me Love You, a fan letter to Clark Gable, the biggest MGM movie star. It led to radio appearances, it led to a record contract, a hit record with that song. And one of the songwriters of that film, Arthur Freed, also wanted to produce musical movies. And he got permission from the head of MGM to look for a property to build around Judy, because everybody knew there wasn't anybody better. Even then, at the age of 15, she had it, and they wanted to find a showcase for her. And he bought the Wizard of Oz property for her. There's one of those big urban legends that has gotten blown way out of proportion that said, oh, you know, they really wanted Shirley Temple and it almost wasn't Judy Garland and they didn't want Judy Garland. And that's just a legend. When the pre-production budget on Wizard of Oz went to over $2 million, the money people who ran MGM from New York said, well, you know, we love Judy and we know she's going to be a star, but can you possibly borrow Shirley Temple because we need box office insurance on a property this size? But 20th Century Fox wasn't going to release Shirley Temple. None of the MGM music people wanted Shirley. They admired her, but they said, point blank, she cannot sing the way we're going to want this role sung. Basically, it was always all about Judy. The script and the songs, especially Over the Rainbow, were written for her. And it was the showcase that she had earned and that she got. When I do my talk at the Figge on Thursday, the 11th of August, it's going to be a heavily illustrated slide talk on the making of the Wizard of Oz movie. And some of this will be touched upon. There'll be many pictures of the early costume and makeup concepts, fortunately scrapped for Judy, for the Scarecrow, for the Tin Man, for the Lion, for the Wicked Witch. Talk about the scripts that were junked, that went far, far away from the original Frank Baum story. Glimpses of the scenes that were filmed and cut from the motion picture, that'll all be part of what I discuss at the Figge. And then when I speak at the Adler on the 13th, it'll be a shorter presentation, but I'll be telling people fun stuff that they can spot as they watch the picture, some little discrepancies, some little fun things, and I have no problem summoning up enthusiasm for these topics. This is stuff I have loved for decades, and the nice thing is that you can talk to just about anybody over the age of 3 and start talking about Dorothy and the Scarecrow and company, and they're going to know exactly what you're talking about. Those characters are Frank Baum's imagination and indelibly etched thanks to what MGM did with that movie.
Guests Judy Garland and Oz expert John Fricke. Tim fills us in on other exhibits at the Figge.
We have a show of photographs by David Plowden, who is a really well-known American photographer. He's been working for about 60 years. Classic photographs of railroads and the Midwest and kind of the industrial, what you call the Rust Belt. And then on the fourth floor, we have a show called Picturing the Prairie that is six artists whose work is about the tall grass prairie.
And also the Rembrandt?
That's coming in the fall. We have a show called Rembrandt and the Jews that is Rembrandt etchings. And in Amsterdam in the 17th century, there were a lot of Jewish refugees from Spain and Portugal, from the Inquisition, and also from Eastern Europe. And his neighborhood was a neighborhood that they lived in. And actually, he lived like three blocks away from Spinoza, the Jewish philosopher. It's bizarre to think about. But the show is kind of based on the premise that his Old Testament images were really inspired by these people that he saw on the street every day and that he knew. And he did actually several portraits of known people in the Jewish community in Amsterdam. And we're going to kind of add into this show some other prints by Rembrandt and also prints by his contemporaries and materials about Amsterdam in that period, which was an incredible, you know, intellectual center. It was where, you know, the pilgrims went to Holland to get away from England, you know, and all these refugees came. So it's a very interesting place to look at, kind of in context of the world now. And we're doing a show of Gary Kelly from Cedar Falls, Iowa, who he's illustrated over 20 children's books. And we are focusing on two books that he did that are about musicians. One is about Paganini, the violinist, and the other is about Robert Johnson, the father of the blues. And the link between the two is that they were said to have sold their souls to the devil to have this unbelievable musical skill. And so the show is called The Devil His Due. And so it'll be drawings and preparatory works for the books. And other, I think he's going to kind of construct an environment, and there will be music in the gallery, and it should be a really fun show. He's an amazing artist, real treasure. And we're bringing The Portrait of Makokita by Rose Franson back to Davenport in the fall. It'll open October 1st. And it is a multi-panel artwork with portraits of 180 residents of Makokita and this giant panoramic landscape. And we're really looking forward to having it back at the Figge.
The Figge Art Museum's Executive Director, Tim Schiffer, along with Judy Garland and Wizard of Oz expert, John Fricke. For more information on the Figge exhibits and Adler film showing, please see figgeartmuseum.org. Today's iWard Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for August goes to Josh Duffy, Norman Ussery, Charles Swanson, Joseph Junta, Tim Schiffer, and John Fricke. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner. Assistance thanks goes to IPR's John Pemble, Jim Davies, and Phil Moss. Operations thanks goes to IPR's Jason Burns, Sean McLean, Nick Brinks, and music director Al Shares. Program research was provided by Rachel Berenger. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.